At the death of Kublai, there was a main Mongol Empire with Peking as its capital, including all China and Mongolia. There was a second great Mongol Empire, that of Kipchak, in Russia. There was a third in Persia, that founded by Hulagu, the Ilkhan Empire, to which the Seljuk Turks in Asia Minor were tributary. There was a Siberian state between Kipchak and Mongolia, and another separate state, Great Turkey, in Turkestan. It's particularly remarkable that India, beyond the Punjab, was never invaded by the Mongols during this period, and that an army under the Sultan of Egypt completely defeated Ketboga, Hulagu's general, in Palestine in 1260, and stopped them from entering Africa. By 1260, the impulse of Mongol conquest had already passed its zenith. Thereafter, the Mongol story is one of division and decay. The Mongol dynasty that Kublai Khan had founded in China, the Huan dynasty, lasted from 1280 until 1368. Later on, a recrudescence of Mongolian energy in Western Asia was destined to create a still more enduring monarchy in India. Third. Now, this story of Mongolian conquests is surely the most remarkable in all history. The conquests of Alexander the Great can't compare with them in extent, and their effect in diffusing and broadening men's ideas, though such things are more difficult to estimate, is at least comparable to the spread of the Hellenic civilization which is associated with Alexander's adventure. For a time, all Asia and Western Europe enjoyed an open intercourse. All the roads were temporarily open, and representatives of every nation appeared at the court of Karakorum. The barriers between Europe and Asia, set up by the religious feud of Christianity and Islam, were lowered. Great hopes were entertained by the papacy for the conversion of the Mongols to Christianity. Their only religion so far had been shamanism, a primitive paganism. Envoys of the Pope, Buddhist priests from India, Parisian and Italian and Chinese artificers, Byzantine and Armenian merchants mingled with Arab officials and Persian and Indian astronomers and mathematicians at the Mongol court. We hear too much in history of the campaigns and massacres of the Mongols, and not enough of their indubitable curiosity and zest for learning. Not perhaps as an originative people, but as transmitters of knowledge and methods, their influence upon the world's history has been enormous, and everything one can learn of the vague and romantic personalities of Genghis or Kublai tends to confirm the impression that these men were built upon a larger scale, and were at least as understanding and creative monarchs as either that flamboyant but egotistical figure, Alexander the Great, or that raiser of political ghosts, that energetic but illiterate theologian, Charlemagne. The missionary enterprises of the papacy in Mongolia ended in failure. Christianity was losing its persuasive power. The Mongols had no prejudice against Christianity. They evidently preferred it at first to Islam. But the missions that came to them were manifestly using the power in the great teachings of Jesus to advance the vast claims of the Pope to world dominion. Christianity, so vitiated, wasn't good enough for the Mongol mind. To make the empire of the Mongols part of the kingdom of God might have appealed to them, but not to make it a fief of a group of French and Italian priests, whose claims were as gigantic as their powers and outlook were feeble, who were now the creatures of the Emperor of Germany, now the nominees of the King of France, and now the victims of their own petty spites and vanities. In 1269, Kublai Khan sent a mission to the Pope, with the evident intention of finding some common mode of action with Western Christendom. He asked that 100 men of learning and ability should be sent to his court to establish an understanding. His mission found the Western world popeless, and engaged in one of those disputes about the succession that are so frequent in the history of the papacy. For 2 years there was no pope at all. When at last a pope was appointed, he dispatched 2 Dominican friars to convert the greatest power in Asia to his rule. Those worthy men were appalled by the length and hardship of the journey before them, and found an early excuse for abandoning the expedition. But this abortive mission was only one of a number of attempts to communicate, and always they were feeble and feeble-spirited attempts, with nothing of the conquering fire of the earlier Christian missions. Innocent IV had already sent some Dominicans to Karakoram, and St. Louis of France had also dispatched missionaries and relics by way of Persia. Mangu Khan had numerous Nestorian Christians at his court, and subsequent papal envoys actually reached Pekin. We hear of the appointment of various legates and bishops to the east, but many of these seem to have lost themselves, and perhaps their lives, before they reached China. There was a papal legate in Pekin in 1346, but he seems to have been a mere papal diplomatist. With the downfall of the Mongolian Huan dynasty in 1368, the dwindling opportunity of the Christian missions passed altogether. The House of Huan was followed by that of Ming, a strongly nationalist Chinese dynasty, at first very hostile to all foreigners. There may have been a massacre of the Christian missions. Until the later days of the Mings, in 1644, little more is heard of Christianity, whether Nestorian or Catholic, in China. Then a fresh and rather more successful attempt to propagate Catholic Christianity in China was made by the Jesuits, but this second missionary wave reached China by the sea. In the year 1298, a naval battle occurred between the Genoese and the Venetians, in which the latter were defeated. Among the 7,000 prisoners taken by the Genoese was a Venetian gentleman named Marco Polo, who had been a great traveller, and who was very generally believed by his neighbours to be given to exaggeration. He had taken part in that first mission to Kublai Khan, and had gone on when the 2 Dominicans turned back. While this Marco Polo was a prisoner in Genoa, he beguiled his tedium by talking of his travels to a certain writer named Rusticiano, who wrote them down. We'll not enter here into the vexed question of the exact authenticity of Rusticiano's story. We don't certainly know in what language it was written, but there can be no doubt of the general truth of this remarkable narrative, which became enormously popular in the 14th and 15th centuries with all men of active intelligence. The Travels of Marco Polo is one of the great books of history. It opens this world of the 13th century, this century which saw the reign of Frederick II and the beginnings of the Inquisition, to our imaginations, as no mere historian's chronicle can do. It led directly to the discovery of America. It begins by telling of the journey of Marco's father, Niccolo Polo, and uncle, Maffeo Polo, to China. These 2 were Venetian merchants of standing, living in Constantinople, and some when, about 1260, they went to the Crimea and thence to Kazan. From that place they journeyed to Bukhara, and at Bukhara they fell in with a party of envoys from Kublai Khan in China to his brother Hulagu in Persia. These envoys pressed them to come on to the great Khan, who at that time had never seen men of the Latin peoples. They went on, and it's clear they made a very favourable impression upon Kublai, and interested him greatly in the civilization of Christendom. They were made the bearers of that request for 100 teachers and learned men, intelligent men acquainted with the 7 arts, able to enter into controversy, and able clearly to prove to idolaters and other kinds of folk that the law of Christ was best, to which we've just alluded. But when they returned, Christendom was in a phase of confusion, and it was only after a delay of 2 years that they got their authorization to start for China again in the company of those 2 faint-hearted Dominicans. They took with them young Marco, and it's due to his presence and the boredom of his subsequent captivity at Genoa that this most interesting experience has been preserved to us.